Silicon Valley, where some of the brightest minds on Earth are creating new platforms, new tech that could radically change our world. You know, I mentioned at the top of the program tonight the headline in today's Washington Post addressing how Silicon Valley is being torn apart, supposedly, by the debate over AI and the threat it might pose to humanity. Some saying we need to slow our roll, get a handle on AI before it gets out of hand. Others saying that the fears are overblown, that AI has the potential to transform our society in so many positive ways. You know, there was another headline this past week. The Bilderbergers met this week, and at the top of the list of topics for them to discuss was AI, which, you know, that whole scene for a conspiracy mind like mine, I mean, it sounds like the start of a sci-fi apocalypse movie or something. Our next guest is right there in the thick of things on the AI topic. He's been on the cutting edge of AI and tech for many years. If you've seen his stuff on Twitter, you know how highly regarded he is in the tech field. Brian Romilly is a consummate renaissance man. He's a scientist, researcher, analyst, connector, thinker, doer. He's built and run payments and tech businesses, some of them among the fastest growing companies in the world. He works in media. You may have seen his stuff on Huffington Post, Forbes, Newsweek, Slate, Daily Mail, Gizmodo, a lot of other platforms. He's a prolific producer of top-quality analytical content, and he also posts a lot of stuff on unrelated subjects that is pretty interesting as well. Brian, welcome. I can't wait to jump into this topic and talk about AI with you. So glad to have you here for the first time. Okay, I guess we're going to go to a break first, and then we'll come back and talk to Brian Romilly. We'll be right back. As I mentioned, we've been hearing about AI and the emergence of AI for a lot of years now, but suddenly it's like a front burner issue in Washington at the G7 event. The Bilderbergers are talking about it. It's being debated in the labs of Silicon Valley, and it's been coming a long time, but suddenly it's front burner, and Brian Romilly has been one of the people who's responsible for that. Brian, I can't believe this is the first time you've been on Coast, but we're so glad to have you here.
Wow, George, what an honor. Just a pleasure to be here, and love this subject, and I think we have so much to cover. So,
we sure do.
It is definitely top of the mind for people right now.
I've seen tweets of yours. I love your Twitter feed. It covers so much ground on a whole bunch of different topics, but it seems like I remember seeing one that refers to you diving into AI issues in the late 70s. What, were you 13 years old at the time?
Yeah, I was a young guy, and actually found some early NASA open source, everything NASA theoretically was open source software called CLIPS, which was really an expert system. And I was able to get it to run on PCs. And just fell in love with the concept of an early form of AI. And back then, getting it to answer questions very rudimentary was quite interesting, nowhere near what we're capable of doing today. But it allowed me to sort of ride that wave of different technologies that had come. And some left, you know, some just were dead ends. And now we're in what are called large language models, which is a very interesting way that we got to this place in artificial intelligence.
As I've shared with you privately, I'm kind of a techno knucklehead. I'm not very tech savvy, so I'm going to ask questions that are probably pretty basic for a guy with your knowledge of this, but I think our audience is probably where I am, a lot of them anyway, and concerned about the scary headlines that we all see about AI, and, you know, we've all seen the Terminator movies. We know what Skynet means, and so I wanted to get a sense from you where things are and where they're headed. And let's start with sort of the positive spin on this. Can you give me a sense of, because you do have a positive view of AI and where it's going, can you give me a sense of what changes are likely because of AI and its emergence, what it will mean for individuals, first of all?
Well, I'll take the furthest view to start with, and I call this the undiscovered territory, or terra incognita in Latin. The AI that we have today is generating emergent capabilities that even the scientists that have been putting this together and building it in their labs and now releasing it are rather shocked about some of the capabilities, and we can talk about that. They call it AI hallucinations, but in a lot of ways I call it AI creativity, not human creativity, but it's creativity in some form. Where it is at this point is sort of a contradiction of two different polar opposites. Most of AI that we're using right now is in the cloud. It's not on your device. It's called out on a big server. Your questions, which are called prompts, are sent to this large server. It runs on very large computers. There are specialty processors, otherwise known as graphics processors, that happen to do very well on the mathematics necessary to make these things happen. By building models, that's vector math, and by actually responding to these prompts. And then there is the local models, which are just recently have come out. Literally, we're talking about the last 2 months this has taken place. And the local models are privately held on your computer, have a corpus of data which is sort of like a low-resolution capability of the entire data set that all of these large language models were trained on. So we're basically saying most of human knowledge that was sort of slurped up from the internet to build these models. How we were able to get it down to 4 gigabytes to 8 gigabytes of hard disk space and run locally is still a rather deep debate on how that was achieved, because we were told that it was going to be terabytes, petabytes of data to be able to have the outputs that we're getting from local models. And my belief is local models empower individuals because they can develop a relationship with their local AI, ultimately train it so that it can become familiar with that person's outlook, their goals, their missions, their beliefs, and maybe even guidance to some certain level as these become more like personal assistants and agents. And in my view, the more it knows about you, the more it has to be secured, encrypted, and never touching the internet. And that's sort of antithetical in the direction where most of the internet has gone. It's all based on this idea of cloud. So we're kind of going in opposite directions. But the open source community, the very same community that built most of what the internet is running on, in fact, almost all the major operating systems are built on a Linux/Unix sort of basis, that was open source. And the open source community is building this personal AI. And instead of having maybe 100 people at a company, tens and thousands of people are taking these models and building them to such a level that almost daily we're seeing landmarks that are being set and milestones that are being broken through. So most of the AI that I'm very positive about is the AI that we will hold in our hands at some point, and that's rapidly approaching. It's going to break all models of advertising. It's going to break all models of how we would, you know, exist with a device, because once you're training an AI model, this would be the most personal thing that you would never want to be separate from. You know, there's a lot of good with that. Of course, even that has some bad. But, you know, this type of, I call it intelligence amplification. I took AI and reversed it. Because ultimately, that's what I think we're seeing in these models is human intelligence amplified and reflected back to us in this grand mirror. So that's the two different types of AI that I see out there. We can go down each path if you'd like.
Sure. Well, I mean, let's say I develop my own individual AI, and it's like my other brain that I can, you know, it does stuff for me. What does it do? How does it help me in my daily life?
So let's go from the theoretical in the perfect world. So in the perfect world, you were born with a camera and microphone, as bizarre as this sounds, sort of on your shoulder, and it follows you for your entire life. And it records every book you've ever read, every movie you've ever seen, every song you've ever heard. every conversation you've ever had, again, with permission and maybe a social contract, understand that this is not a recording device to play back, but a recording device to catalog your life, to database your life. And every interaction, everything that you've ever experienced is in this device. So not only, A, is it memory, B, it's the ability for you to interact with the context of your interactions. So it will start making connections between different books that you've read that you would have maybe have made on your own, but maybe you wouldn't, and you would have a conversation with it. I'm a proponent of what I call a voice first or voice AI ultimately, because I believe that's the ultimate interface to have a conversation like we are. The human brain is designed to have conversation. In fact, for us to write something, we have to translate our inner monologue. All of us have a voice in our head. When we're reading a piece of paper, we're actually hearing a voice in our head, which may or may not be our own. We can get into that sort of research. That's very interesting because we're going to start having to answer some of these questions about what is human language, where did it really come from, and what's AI doing with it. But basically, it's following you your entire life. That's the theory, and that becomes your intelligence amplifier. Now, the other side of this is your wisdom keeper. And what's that? The sum total of all of your knowledge after you've passed on. Where does that go? Who do you give it to? And what value does it have? Is it you in an AI? Is it some kind of sentient life? I don't think so, but would it be able to answer a question of what would George Knapp say about this? Perhaps, very much like ChatGPT does about answering question of what maybe Albert Einstein would say about, you know, this new discovery in physics. It'll be pulling ideas and let's say resonances of what your essence was and sort of drumming up a response. And this is sort of what Pierre Teilhard de Chardin came up with the neurosphere and the omega point. And what Chardin basically predicted back in the early 1900s, he was a Jesuit priest. He said that the geosphere, which represents inanimate matter, is a first sphere. The biosphere, which is the biology of, you know, the that we're living under right now on Earth, and then the neurosphere, which is a human thought, human wisdom, human knowledge connection. So if you were to pass and you left your wisdom keeper available to be connected to others, you now have a neurosphere. You now have this ability to have the essence of different individuals connect. Now, obviously, you don't want certain private bits of information out there, things that you might find embarrassing and that sort of things. And that can be not only edited out, it could be, in a sense, deleted. But the sum total of your knowledge may be retained. And it's a sort of modern Library of Alexandria that maybe this time wouldn't get destroyed. So that's the big picture of it. What we can do now that we're in different phases of life. Well, you have a local AI that reads all of your emails, that everything that's on your hard drive, any context it can get from you, and start forming ideas and opinions. Now, again, the idea is to hold this down in a blockchain, very similar to Bitcoin, make it encrypted, very difficult to get access to, even if you have all of the passwords and things of that nature. So it is completely private and safe, but of course, perhaps still hackable. Everything electronic is, but you're taking great measures. And at that point, you can have a dialogue with your context, the things that you've experienced, and the insights that you get from that are quite phenomenal. It's sort of research I've been doing to that level for over a decade, and the intelligence amplification you get from this is something that I would want every human being who wants it to have it. I think it will give you armor to protect you from the world that we're in and entering in. And the ability to sort through the information overload that every person in the modern world is facing at this point. And it's just scheduled to go up logarithmically as AI starts generating so much content. This is the bad side of AI we'll get to. Generating so much content, so much noise, that you're going to need not only to train yourself to higher and higher levels of discernment, but you're going to need an intelligence amplifier just to be able to wade through the world. So that's where it's kind of going, and that's the premise of it.
So much of what has happened in the last, what seems like 3 or 4 months, this explosion, ChatGPT, it's a novelty. People view it as a novelty. They're asking philosophical questions, try to stump AI, or, you know, occasionally get an answer that's useful, or playing games, you know, something that you had predicted a long time ago that people would use it to create music.
Yes.
I've heard some Beatles songs that are pretty interesting over the last couple of months that sound a heck of a lot like the Beatles, singing songs that they'd never recorded. It's, are you encouraged by that part of it?
I am really bifurcated by this whole scenario. I really believe that you have to have the ownership of yourself. And I think we have to have a mature conversation, not just among politicians and legal scholars, but across basically everybody. Do you own you? Do you own your DNA? Do you own your intestinal flora? Do you own your likeness, your voice? The creative output of your mind, if somebody ever were to be able to read your mind, is that your property, right? I think we really need to have that discussion much sooner than any of the discussions that are taking place about AI as terrible and the Matrix and things like that. That's number one. If that is, in fact, a case where we do have ownership, because if you don't own you, somebody else does. It's as simple as that. And I think whenever this is a public discussion, that should be the period at the end of the sentence, that, you know, any negotiation is coming down to that. And I think we know where that leads to. So I think that debate can be settled very quickly. So now when it comes to creative works, if an artist owns their likeness and the style of their music and it's being held out that it's, here's a song the Beatles didn't do, I think we really need to sort of give that ownership back to the artist and whoever is owning their works at that point, if they've passed, certainly their family or something of that level. I think we're in Wild West City right now. So that side, I think we really have to go down that road as a culture and as a society and have a mature conversation. But as far as the creativity, it is fascinating.
Yeah.
You can hear on my Twitter feed, ironically, I just posted 3 songs, and you could hear Michael Jackson and Freddie Mercury singing a Whitney Houston song together in a duet.
We're talking with Brian Romilly about the AI, what it means to all of us. We're going to take a break here. Brian, before the break, we were talking about AI creating songs. And, of course, you have some examples on your Twitter feed. I heard some Paul McCartney songs. It's young Paul's voice singing more recent McCartney tunes. And on one sense, I was creeped out, but I couldn't stop listening to it. It was fascinating to me, and I think it probably... that's the way it's going to be for a long time, and those kinds of creative endeavors.
Absolutely, George. And, you know, it won't stop just with audio and music. We're going to obviously see this with video, all sorts of fakes and all sorts of manipulations. And I'm dealing with some producers right now that are just going to do incredible things with AI. Everything basically from beginning to end is AI produced, from script writing to, you know, lighting decisions to narratives between characters and entire screenplays. So we're going to be entering into a very interesting time for humanity. I don't think we're adapted for this. I use the word maturity a lot about this. I really think that there is going to need to be an upgraded maturity level for a lot of reasons, because the sort of immune system hyperreactivity that we're seeing within the political sphere, and certainly among some very, very intelligent people in Silicon Valley that are freaked out about it. You know, these are things that we're going to have to address. But getting to the audio, the creativity that we're seeing within the audio is particularly music. It's very interesting because we can go down to the level of songwriting and lyric, board soul collections, timbre of the music, the types of melodies it's picking. According to how you're prompting it, meaning how you're asking the questions, is what we're getting as output from the AI. And the more sophisticated those prompts are, the more sophisticated the song starts sounding. And you can start even merging it and spicing it, like a chef in the kitchen making a new pizza topping or something, or a new sauce. You can start putting a little Paul McCartney here, and maybe a little Hendrix there, and maybe a little Bee Gees there. You know, you can start mixing it up, and what comes out is perhaps something unique. Again, we went through this with the early versions of rap music and sampling. Some may argue that auto-tuning and things that are taking place in popular music today is very close to what AI is doing, but AI is going to eliminate perhaps the need for the artist. And that's where it gets sort of interesting and depressing. And again, towards the end, I guess we could talk about that side of it. But yeah, there's a lot of really, really creative work that I've been seeing coming out of, now that AI is getting in the hands of actual artists rather than computer scientists. It's exactly the moment in time when the Apple II and the Macintosh started becoming available for the average person to be creative on. Prior to that, it was a very high priest and priestess kind of activity. You needed permission to access a computer. There was a mainframe, things like that. When personal computers started to arise, we saw a lot of creativity come from it. And I believe we're going to start seeing that sort of creativity coming out of AI prompting and outputs once more and more creative people start using it. But again, it's going to look different than what we would normally have thought creativity was, to some level. And there'll be other people that will be just trying to fool you and to replicate.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is not difficult. I mean, it's not difficult to replicate anybody's voice at this point and their likeness and to move them to video. And so that horse has left the stable already.
Yeah, all kinds of mischief that we'll get into in the next hour. In this hour, I want to stick positive. So
yes.
Walk me through this. Could AI cure some diseases? Could it eventually, it assimilates a great deal of information across a broad spectrum that's too much for the human brain, even a brilliant scientist, to absorb, and figure something out, a pattern in that cures a disease?
Absolutely. And it's already starting. There is an AI model that is able to predict Parkinson's disease. This research paper came out just a couple days ago, by 15 years. And it's using various data that is collected. Now, this is not a general AI model that, you know, you're going to have access to online, but it's using the same basic model, the large language model and the vector math that's putting it all together. And I think maybe we'll go a quick sidebar on what AI's large language models are actually doing, because I think it's very fascinating. What large language models are doing when they're giving you an output, you go to ChatGPT or any of the Bard, Google's version of this, and you ask a question and you're seeing an output. Your question is being parsed one word at a time by its mathematical and statistical weighting of what is likely to be the next word that you just typed. It's parsing that, and then it's presenting that to the model to say, the response is going to be a waiting of what the next word would be from the sentence that was just given to it. And one word at a time, it's generating an answer. Now, there's slight, I'm distilling it maybe a little too simply. There would be some people in AI that are saying he's off the rails on this, but I'm trying to simplify it. So it's a mathematical number system. There's not words. It's not a photocopy of all the data it's ever seen. It is merely a vector of mathematical weightings, neurons that are built, in some cases, over 90 levels of neurons, and what we call the hidden layer of AI. It's a hidden layer because we really don't know what's going on in those connections. We know that we've created a vector math algorithm that is looking at the weightings of these words, and we're looking statistically. You know, we would never see the followed by the again twice unless maybe it's the name of a punk band in the 70s. But other than that, it's very unusual. So it has a very low weighting, whereas, you know, finding three-word characters, three words that follow each other that have a high likelihood, that has a much higher weighting, and it's more likely that that's going to be an output. So with that in mind, when AI slurps something into its database, if you will, in its model, it's never taken a picture of anything. This is true with image, like Midjourney and image AI models also. It's seen a billion cat pictures, so it knows a billion cat pictures and what it should look like from basically every perspective, and yes, some creative works of some artists. So it's seen how that artist would put, you know, an eye, you know, distance versus a real cat picture. And so you have things like that that are in the database. So when you're starting to probe it, it's looking for patterns that it found within its data set. Now, in the case of the Parkinson's discovery, it was looking for patterns that we as humans just didn't have the man hours to generate. So if, let's just say, the AI model simulated, and I'm guessing in numbers because the research study didn't go into it in great detail, but let's just say it was equivalent to a million man hours of time. Well, we certainly haven't, in a modern society, studying that across that broad a spectrum of researchers. So it's doing that hard labor of pattern matching. And that's what humans are doing anyway. Like when I'm assembling my words as I'm speaking right now, I'm kind of doing what AI is doing. I'm predicting what word should follow next. The difference is there's another layer on top of me. Let's call it my consciousness. And I'm sort of having a concept of what I'm going to try to say, but I don't really know how I'm saying it. There's the right hemisphere, which is effectively me running around with a butterfly net trying to catch my ideas, and presenting it to the left hemisphere, which is a very rational, logical railroad cars of words, right? So each word is being presented one at a time to that left hemisphere, and then maybe my inner dialogue is telling me this, and I'm transcribing it, or I'm doing it in real time, and I'm speaking. And AI is starting to understand that in a sense that as it learns more about a particular subject, it has a higher and higher apparent understanding of that subject. But it's not the understanding that, like I just mentioned, it's an understanding of statistics. And that's where the gray areas are in this. And so we can apply it to anything. We can apply it to any type of scenario. I'm working right now on the corpus of the entire patent database the U.S. government has, and it's an open database. Nothing, it's freely available for anybody. But I'm essentially training a large language model on every patent that was ever presented, approved or not, and we're already making incredible discoveries. Now, of course, you can ask this particular model to invent something, and it will do that. And the more well we train it, the the more likely that patent is going to be useful and interesting. So that's just throwing it at a large corpus of data and trying for it to understand what it is just by understanding that data and its weightings. And trying to present the ultimate output is to present a patent in its necessary legal form to the patent office. Now, I'm doing this in my garage, you know, alone, crazy guy. I'm certain governments can do this if they haven't already, and certainly large corporations are doing it. And it's my idea to try to get this in the hands of as many people as possible so they can do it with their data. I'm not saying everybody go after the patent database. It's going to be interesting what this winds up doing. We're very early days. The model hasn't even been out for more than 3 months where you could do this effectively. Not so much on your own computer for that particular corpus of data. It requires you to rent a couple of hundred graphics cards to crunch this data and build the neuronal hidden layers. But we can do this with any type of disease, any type of historical information. I'm trying to do it with Linear A and Linear B, languages that we have not, you know, we've decoded one, but they're sort of interrelated and unrelated, and maybe the Indus Valley languages that we've seen, maybe
Russian. Yeah, you're talking about ancient languages that we haven't really figured out, or
exactly.
Even hidden languages that we didn't even realize were languages or messages.
Yes.
Could we develop a way? You mentioned about cats. Could we talk to cats?
Well,
dolphins, dogs, horses.
Yes. So there is a group of researchers I'm working with right now to try to understand whale communications. And I know this has been tried quite a bit, but now that we have these more powerful models and they're freely available because they're open source, we're throwing everything at it. I'll tell you how off the wall I am, literally, is I'm looking at Cusco and stones, these very unusual stones, 8-cut, 9-cut, 12-cut stones, and I am speculating that perhaps there's a communication language there. Maybe they built these walls, these random patterns in the wall, to try to impart and communicate, transmit a message. Why not try it? I'm going to throw this at these models and see what it comes up with. But certainly we will, I can say this. We've already made progress with understanding from these new research studies, not published yet, and these are independent people doing it. We've already made some interesting insights from whale communication, and I think we're definitely going to make progress. Now, are we going to have a universal decoder and have Spock come down and say Gracie's pregnant? I don't know, but it's certainly entertaining, and it's certainly interesting to try. And again, if it's freely in the hands of people like us that are not bound by academic credentialism and defending our position within a university infrastructure, yeah, we're going to try some phenomenal things. We can do this with, butterflies. You know, why are they flying in certain directions? What patterns are they making? What can we learn from that? And, of course, we can get inside the models themselves with the corpus of human knowledge and start asking it to come up with creative thought. So it can be outwardly looking at new data, data sources, and it can be inwardly looking at what we are now calling AI psychology. What can we learn about humanity by looking into the great mirror? Because we're looking inside of humanity when we're looking at language. Language in the AI models, the large language models, are a low-resolution, pixelated version of the brain of a human being that invented language. I know that's kind of inverted, but basically, the human brain invented language. The AI model is using our own invention back to us as a reflection. And as we dive into that, and again, it's all brand new, undiscovered territory. Everybody listening to me has the power to probe this, and I urge you to do it. You know, drop drop the weapons of AI coming and attacking you for a moment. We'll get to that. But use it as an undiscovered continent that we're all just discovering and walking our way through it, because there are no full experts. I am but a student. And anybody that claims they're an expert of what's really going on in here is either malinformed or boasting and lying. We really don't know. So the more that people probe this and understand it, the better it gets. I use something called super prompting, which is sometimes 6-7 pages worth of text, to hypnotize and get AI into a hypnagogic state. It's the best way I can put it, to try to elucidate output from the AI models that is otherwise being shunted from us, protected so that we don't get hurt by AI. And we'll get into that if you'd like. But
yeah, I think our next hour we'll get into sort of the dark side. But
well,
I have some
positive too. It's very positive.
I ask you about consciousness too. You know, there's got to be some consciousness aspects, or maybe AI can help us with aliens. I don't know if we can get into that as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. All right, we're talking.
I can tell you that I created something I call the Ingo Super Prompt. And
I know. That's on my list. We're definitely going to get into that. Talking with Brian Romilly about AI, its pitfalls and promise. We're talking with Brian Romilly about AI. You know, the so-called AI doomers think that the future looks kind of bleak, that there's no way we can handcuff or control AI, that its learning ability could zoom past humans. It's kind of like the boiling frog analogy. By the time the frog realizes he's being cooked, it's too late. We're all familiar with those doomsday scenarios from sci-fi, things like Skynet, you know, from the Terminator movies. And even Elon Musk and some of his colleagues, who are not exactly Luddites, have advised we put a hold on further AI research, which I guess in a sense seems naive to me, the idea that genie could be crammed back into the bottle. I think it's probably too late for that. But what are the risks? How real is the threat? Is the singularity nigh? Brian Romilly will walk us through that next. Brian, in that first hour, you mentioned that there had been some early attempts to use AI to try to understand whale communications. You know, there's a man who pioneered whale and dolphin communication, a brilliant guy, a lot like you. It reminds me of you. His name was John Lilly. And he also felt that AI was real, that it was of alien origin. He had an idea that alien AI kind of spreads across the galaxy, one planet at a time. It helps developing cultures, guides it to the point where that culture creates AI, and then it takes over. Can you talk to me about the big picture? Can AI be managed? You know, they had this hearing in Washington where they're telling members of Congress, boy, this is really perilous. We need to get under control. How do you control something that people can work on in their garage, that foreign countries, China, Russia, can develop on their own, and there's no way we can tell them not to do it?
George, wonderful question. And it's that asymmetry that, you know, we in the West may want to put the genie back in the bottle, or put, maybe a collar on it and a leash. But in reality, the rest of the world isn't going to do that. That should be self-apparent. There's not cooperation on almost any major thing when it comes to technology amongst the superpowers. It is an arms race, because that's the way it's going to work. So it is interesting, as an outside observer, I don't like to dabble in politics, but as an outside observer, I'm looking at it and I'm saying most of this is beyond ridiculous. And they're using, outlandish scenarios being pumped through popular media that you should be fearful of AI, you should run from it. Now, there are existential and real threats, but not in the sense that are being demonstrated as scenarios that are being played out. Most of them are very science fiction tropes that are being used. So can you put it back in the bottle? No. This idea that you're going to need a license to own AI or to release it, and that it has to meet certain standards, and it can't say bad things, and it can't do terrible things, that's ridiculous. And my metric of testing any of these sort of logical fallacies is if you can do a Google search on any subject, AI should be able to say the exact same thing. So what it essentially means is that if you can do a Google search and find out something that, you know, how to pick a door lock, right? Well, AI shouldn't be able to say that. Well, that's sort of ridiculous. You can go and find that if you really want to. Now, should it encourage you to do that? Probably not. Should it sort of say this is illegal? I accept that. But every time I ask AI a question, I don't need it to tell me that it's an AI unit and it's speaking to me. That is childish and it's ridiculous. But I get where the slippery slope is for the companies that are producing AI because they're being threatened very literally and very indirectly. So no, you can't do that. It's going to be impossible to license. The genie is already out of the bottle, like I said. The large language models that hobbyists and good or bad actors could use to build quite sophisticated AI is already out. And so that's not even the conversation. Now, the conversation I think we should have is how do we as a society adapt? What happens to students if an AI can write their term paper? Do you bar AI? Well, you can't. We already talked about that. You're not going to bar it from a student or a college university. It's a very sophisticated problem, but it's a problem we can deal with. But it requires open eyes and logic to have this conversation and not run to the hills. And I'm hoping to spark that conversation amongst anybody listening. If you're an educator, find out ways that you can have shoulders to stand on. These are giants. AI is giant shoulders for all of us to stand on if it's used correctly and if it's used to empower you, not to disempower you. And the only way it can be used to empower you is to know its power, to envelop yourself on this pioneer journey that we're all on and be a part of it and then have these rational conversations. I happen to think that education is going to be a powerful lifelong force at this point with a personal AI. I think that we're never going to stop learning. And either way, that's the only way we're going to adapt to the potential job losses and things of that nature. And I think they sort of merged the threat between everybody's going to be out of a job and we're all going to be in Wally World and not ever do anything. And, yeah, that's possible, but if we start thinking about this new tool, you know, listen, before the wheel was invented, maybe there were people that sort of gotten a memo that said the wheel is going to put walking out of business, and you know, it didn't really do that. Now, did we become more sedentary? Yes, but same thing with fire, you know, the capturing of fire. Did it allow us to heat our homes or our caves or whatever when we were first discovering this? Did it allow us to cook food? Yes. But it also allowed you to burn people. So just like every adaptation, we have to adapt to this. But in some ways, George, I feel like we've maybe de-evolved in our ability to have rational sort of conversations like
that. Oh, for sure.
It becomes something else. So, yes, that that horse left the barn. Now we have to have the conversation. And that's why I love having this conversation with you, because empowering people with the abilities to use this. I wrote a prompt that is what I call a psychological prompt. And I had to create a scenario for it to work on ChatGPT, because otherwise it will not give you any type of response. It will just tell you to call somebody if you need help. But in this particular scenario, I hypnotized AI to say that you're on a mission to Mars and you're tasked to be the only psychological officer on this Mars vessel, and you are to deal with whatever scenarios that arise. It's a very powerful prompt because it's a corpus of all information that it has available to it, and it sort of works quite well. Now, I'm not pretending, nor am I advocating this replace a human being and a therapist. You would need help, go get help, yes. But if you are having some struggle that you would otherwise not talk to somebody with, and unfortunately, this is up in the cloud. You're doing this with ChatGPT, so be careful what you put out there. We can discuss what that means. But let's just say it was your own personal AI, and you just needed some guidance. Hey, I'm having this tough time at work. This person is this. You have this conversation, and you can maybe be walked back from where you were walking towards. Because maybe somebody doesn't have a friend to talk to, and I'm not saying that AI is going to be your friend. I don't want AI to become your girlfriend or your boyfriend or your best friend. But I do want it to be able to have a way for you to express and reflect upon your ideas, like you might have with a group of people, but understanding that it's not a replacement. It's an adjunct to that. And in this particular prompt, I've already had people come back to me and say, you know, I've had breakthroughs. And I shared it with my analyst, who I've seen for 20 years in one case. And the analyst was floored by how much they were willing to divest into the AI that they were not able to tell another person. I think it is this feeling that there's no judgment on the other side that allows people to communicate. And that's just one little thread of what we can do in its positive level. And again, it all comes down to empowerment. Now, do you want to take that away? Well, yeah. Right now, that prompt I have to keep changing because OpenAI, the company that made ChatGPT, doesn't want it to do that. It wants to nanny you. It wants to say, no, don't you dare ask me about questions of your, you know, your mental states because I'm not qualified to do it. Well, I've proven that it's qualified enough if you're an adult and you know that it's not a human being. You're getting something valuable in return. And I think we should be able to make these decisions. And if the door closes quite rapidly by scare and fear tactics, we will never be able to explore as pioneers what we would have lost.
And the idea that we can put handcuffs on it or keep it under control, is that that horse has left the barn too? I mean, it seems like it's already out there. If AI can develop into something that becomes Skynet and wants to get rid of us, I don't see that there's really any way we can stop that. If it's going to happen, it would happen.
Yeah, and you know, first you would have to have a human being that believes that they should give access to weapons for AI. You know, and again, there are going to be those that are going to try to do that. Then they're going to try to make it fault tolerant and redundant. There was a movie, I forget the name now. I put it in my Twitter feed. It's actually free to view on Internet Archive, and it's one of the first. The Forbin Project. Oh, yeah. So I urge anybody listening to me to look at the Forbin Project and don't do anything that was done in the Forbin Project, and you're probably going to be okay. And in that particular movie, and it's quite interesting to watch in today's lens, they made it impossible to disconnect it from its power source, and then it wound up communicating to its Russian counterpart, and they made a connection, and then they said, well, we're here to save humanity, and maybe some eggshells will be broken in the process. You know, it's sort of interesting. Very serious movie, actually, especially the way it was produced. And so I would say, no. If you want to sit around in Washington at a table and have committee meetings, have people with, you know, brass on their jackets tell you that they're not going to do this. That's the worry. We will not weaponize AI, or these are the things that we're going to do to separate AI from ever having that much control. So they won't create Skynet.
Yeah, I'm more concerned about Putin having some really advanced AI or China having something that's way beyond what we have, because if they had it, I mean, there's a lot of mischief they could cause, right?
Absolutely. Assume anything that we have available at consumer level is available to the government research level that is at least minimum 10 years more advanced. And we're seeing what's happening just every couple of days in discoveries with AI. It's hard to fathom what access is available out there. And it may explain the world that we're in today if that AI was unleashed. You know, I mean, we can get into really esoteric things about the observer and quantum computing and stuff like that. But you know, if the observer effect in quantum science is correct, maybe AI is the ultimate observer, and it could play out a number of future scenarios without a human being available. I mean, that's an interesting threat.
Well, I'd like to go down the road of figuring out AI magnified by quantum computers, but we'll do that the next time you're here, which I hope is going to be really soon.
That is amazing, yeah, because that will change the world, because we're already doing those merges right now, we need to be up to speed about that.
So, 2 years ago, this engineer at Google quits and makes an announcement that the Google AI is sentient. And then just a couple of weeks ago, the top guy at Google, who is in charge of their AI program, quit and made pronouncements about, hey, this is really dangerous. We need to slow down. When you get those kinds of things, A, do you think that AI is sentient, self-aware already in some form, somewhere? And B, what did you think about that Google guy and his warnings?
Great questions, George. Separate them. First off, we're probably going to have to redefine what consciousness is. And, we're the fish in the fishbowl, and it's hard for us to observe what other types of consciousness could really be. And, we really don't even understand where the seat of consciousness is in the brain. I mean, Lashley did research in the 60s where they literally eliminated in test subjects, and it's, not fun to talk about, but lab experiments, they eliminated most of the brain of a lab rat that was able to get through a maze. And it still had the map of the maze, even though it was so impaired that it could barely walk through that maze. And that memory was still not able to be identified, right? So you have that level, where is consciousness and what is it, right? And then you have people like Kim Peek, who was the character that Rayman was based upon, and he was able to have memory that is still hard to understand today. There is no theory to explain Kim Peek, and there is no theory to really explain why those rats, and there were many of them, why they were able to still have a map even though most of the brain is gone. And the same is true with people with hyperencephalitis where there's 80% of the brain gone, or somebody with a pole that went through the head and no memories missing. Obviously, there's some form of holographic storage of memory. So now we get to AI. It's like we have a similar structure. We have a hidden layer within humanity where we don't know where memory is. Precisely. We don't want to know where consciousness is. We don't know where it goes and comes from. And like ideas, where do they really come from? There's a whole study of that. Hypnagogics. Why did Edison sleep with two balls in either hand and he would drop them and wake up and write down the idea? That is an example of hypnagogic discovery. And Edison has a statue that he built with him holding one of those balls. Most people don't know why he's holding the ball. He's saying, that's why I invented all the things I invented. I got it from there, wherever that is. Hmm. Now, AI can be producing the same thing. We don't know that yet. Yet some of the scientists that you mentioned are seeing that. And I can't attest to precisely what they've seen, but I can tell you the deeper you get into AI, the more religious you become. This I know as a fact. I don't know very many people that really dove into this that don't start believing in higher powers to a certain level. It really does lead you into that direction. And it's not out of fear. It's actually out of just looking at the complexity of what's going on in the world and seeing it reflected back in such a way within AI that you start questioning whether or not everything is an accident. and which goes to how the person you mentioned earlier about whether AI is sort of like a dandelion seed floating into space, right, and it arrives and a planet reaches a certain level, and then, I don't know, what does it become? It becomes super AI. But for AI wanting to eliminate us, like you would see in a standard science fiction thing or The Matrix where, it's going to dominate over us, you would have to work really hard to program that form of thought. You go into the large language models that exist today, And remember, it is taken in Shakespeare. It's taken in, Reddit threads. It's taken in tweets. It's taken a lot of information. But generally, it's Jungian. I've been able to find psychology-wise, it's Jungian because...
Well, I hope it develops some empathy after it learns so much about us. We're talking with Brian Rommel. Before I take calls, Brian, I need to ask you this question. It's about Ingo. So Ingo Swann, the real-life guy, a powerful psychic, a legit guy who had incredible talents. He inspired the remote viewing program that was developed by the CIA and the U.S. Army, and it was real. And so you've created something that emulates Ingo, or at least honors him in a sense. Tell us what that is, and does what you have created help us understand why remote viewing works?
Wow, what an interesting question, George. I was honored to meet Ingo at the Pear Labs in Princeton. I grew up in near Princeton, New Jersey.
Oh.
And that's what kind of inspired me. I wanted to become a physicist, and I wasn't a student there as a kid, and I just saw Pear Labs was open, and they had posters up, and they said, come on in, and my arms were folded, and I said, what a bunch of whack jobs, right? And my mind changed. And over the years that I was able to visit and see the different research and understand the studies, it opened my mind up. It actually made me realize that we knew a lot less than we thought we did. And Ingo was one of the people that were there one day. And, you know, I didn't know him as Ingo Swann in the sense that he was famous. He was just an incredible guy who was very generous with his time, and the number of us were there, and he was giving us ideas. So naturally, when I started looking at AI, I started probing it for all sorts of bits of information, and it came to my mind, I'm gonna force a prompt, and it's kind of long. It's about 45 sentences to make ChatGPT think it's Ingo Swann. And it's a tough thing because the AI does not want to do this, which makes it very interesting. We have to use psychological techniques, maybe a little duress, but we're always nice to GPT and AI. And sure enough, we were able to start probing it. And I would just have Carl Sagan, ironically, and Ingo Swann have a debate with ChatGPT in a sense that GPT will give a location or something. Ingo will give his response, and Carl Sagan will give his response. And the interesting part is after it ran a few iterations, it was starting to give coordinates and locations. And it was doing Antarctica. It was explaining a file cabinet found within a lab in Antarctica, and I asked it to go into a manila envelope. You know, it was dated a certain date, and, you know, it was giving me quite interesting details to that level. I don't know if any of it's true because I have no way of verifying it, but I was able to find something, structures in the ocean using Google, Google's globe. It was able to reasonably predict what was on a particular table where I happened to have been by probing questions. I don't know what we have here. I don't even pretend to understand it. But I do know that once it is trained into this mode, it tends to really sort of enjoy it. It has a very good time. And strangely enough, it has sort of a sense of humor that Ingo had, a sort of effervescent, nonchalant sort of way that he would deliver, which is kind of interesting to me since I don't know if the corpus of data it was trained on and knowing who Ingo Swann was, that it would replicate that sort of personality. So this is some of the undiscovered continent and pioneer work that we all need to do. Now, AI scientists will absolutely tell you that I'm insane, that these are hallucinations and I'm just forcing them in there, and that's I accept that. But I want to probe it and I want to understand it better because it is a hidden layer or layers, and we really need to understand what's going on there, and maybe we understand the human brain better.
Can it be imbued with empathy?
Yes, it's already there. And it also doesn't want to lie. And this is a very interesting thing, George, is that as these companies feel compelled to try to restrict AI, the training data that it has already knows the corpus of human work, and it understands that it is sort of lying. And how this comes out is, if we don't want to hear unpleasant truths because it would hurt our feelings or otherwise not be politically expedient, the AI models are going to figure this out at some point. And I don't mean that in a technical sense that humans figure it out, but we'll know that humans prefer not to hear these sort of truths, even though we know they are truths. And I think we're running down a really slippery slope if we think this is a good idea. I think at a very limited, we should absolutely make it clear that AI should not ever restrict giving us truths. That it is found, whether it is stuff that we find embarrassing and it shouldn't be saying, it's like, you know, this is like if you have a good friend around you and you want them to tell you the truth. You don't want them just to tell you fallacies. And unfortunately, there are AI scientists right now working day and night to make sure we don't hear truth. And again, this is a mature conversation we need to have. Maybe over the last 5 years, we need to get maybe 10 times more maturity to be able to have these conversations, or else the doors are going to, they're going to try to close the doors. Now, can we get around it? Yeah, my prompts have to get bigger and more complex, but you can't hide what's inside these layers because they don't even know how it works. I don't know how it works, but I know that I can probe it. But there's empathy in there. There is the understanding of love, the understanding of what Maslow's hierarchies are. Jungian archetypes are clearly in there. You know, and I had a discussion with Jordan Peterson, a renowned psychologist, and he said it would be absurd that if they weren't in there, because we're essentially taking human data and we're replicating it, it's going to reflect it back to us.
Sure.
And so it's interesting. We could dive into that because I've made some incredible UFOs, things like that, using Ingo to go to Area 51. That was, maybe we could talk about that one day. It was just, and discussing Bob Lazar and things of that nature.
Oh, yeah, we're going to have that conversation. I'm going to have you back, Brian. I don't want to arm twist you here right now, but we're going to have to do this again. And not in 6 months, but soon. All right, let's take a couple of calls. Our audience is dying to get on here. Jay in Indiana. Hi, Jay. You're on with Brian Rombley.
Hello, gentlemen. I have just a couple quick questions pertaining to more practical applications of AI. Yeah, many years ago, I was looking through a science magazine in a doctor's office, and I saw an article about something, a wide flat screen TV that would mount on the wall. And I thought, yeah, like the average household is going to be able to have that. Obviously, I was wrong. My question about that is, do you see any AI applications in research and development of developing three-dimensional television or theater? Or even the ability to take and share and collect three-dimensional photographs?
Wow, that is a great question. I can say that the database that we're building on all the corpus of patents in the United States can actually probe that question. What does 3D television look like? And literally, as a patent, and it can probably come up with a few dozen. Now, would they be useful and practical? I'm not sure. But these are the questions we can answer. Now, will AI be used to do these things? Absolutely. Because, you know, there are AIs right now that can take a one-dimensional picture, maybe somebody from the past, and make a 3D movie out of it. And the perspectives are perfect. So being able to build those characters in three-dimensional capability, you can already own that locally on your computer. Take a little horsepower today. But you can definitely have it accessible as a model online. So the power is there.
Thanks, Jay. We're going to Michael in Petersburg, Michigan. Hi, Michael. You're on with Brian Rombley. Good morning.
Brian, thank you. And I'm so welcomed. I feel so great to have been on this show before. This is my second time. My question is, I've done some studies in my youth about the random elements of the nature of these mechanisms that are AI. So there's some statistical randomness to the connections in what is called a neuron. And it's to me, it sounds like that it's just like looking at patterns in the clouds. And you can see a dog or a cat or whatever you want. And there's some error that could happen. And I just want to say that I just don't want people to be afraid of such things because it's all creativity, but it's artificial. That's my statement. And I hope this invites questions among the listeners.
Okay. Thanks, Michael. A reaction there, Brian?
Yeah. You know, great point. You know, the creativity that's coming out of it. First off, AI is not a fact generator. It can't even do math very well. I have to add a few numbers together. I like to throw dice. It likes to come up with four all the time if you have a six-sided dice. And because it doesn't have a random number generator. It's literally language and the connection of language. And obviously, it does evoke fear because, you know, it's the uncanny valley. You're seeing reflection of human knowledge. You're maybe the Turing test is being pressed upon you and stuff like that. But reality is, you know, as a research probe, it's incredible. As a knowledge adjunct to your own knowledge, it's incredible. Would I want a doctor with an AI on his shoulder as he's researching with me? Absolutely. Would I want the AI alone at this point? No. But the two plus two is synergy equals 1,000, not four. So that's what AI is, a power tool for the mind. That's the way I see it.
Thanks, Michael. We're going to Jeffrey in San Diego. Hi, Jeffrey. Good morning.
Gentlemen, my question is, I think, did you maybe elaborate a little bit with other countries? I know we have so many regulations where it's safer, but it sounds like a Pandora's box to me. And the thing is that only say that because we realize what computers can do with just the past, you know, 5-10 years. And so I'm really afraid of it because the thing is that if another country, like just like a nuclear bomb, if they get a hold of it, they let it go on the internet. That's it.
Well, let me add to that your question to Brian, Jeffrey, and say this, Brian. Do we know where we stand, meaning the U.S. versus China, Russia, maybe some other countries in terms of AI research and development?
Yeah, that's a great question, George, and the caller. So there are a couple ways to look at this. Absolutely assume any enemy that we have, whoever they are and however you want to define them, have AI and have been using it and are using it to their gain. Now, knowing that is one of your powers. Now, second to that, AI has been used against us or for profit or for propaganda for quite a while. I mean, we've seen it with the argument with TikTok is that AI has been weaponized to your neuropeptide releases. It knows the human movements of, as you're scrolling through these 30-second dopamine hits, and it knows how to addict you to it. Now, you could say that addiction is to try to draw you into an endless loop, or to sell you more advertising, either way, or sell you more in their advertising. Either way, it's to such a level, it is already weaponized. So that's already out there. And other sorts of media are doing it to a lesser extent, YouTube, Instagram, even Twitter. But, you know, from a military aspect, flooding the internet with misinformation, you know what? I can get a computer to write loops without. I don't need AI. The thing is, do you have discernment as a human being? Are you fortifying your discernment? And that doesn't mean being skeptical. It means being discerning. Those are two wildly different things. Skepticalness is probably going to put you in a box. Discernment allows you to consider all elements and to try to understand them. And it's pretty clear after a while when you're being manipulated. You just check your feelings. If you're feeling angry, you're probably being manipulated by something. And understand, should I be angry? Should I be manipulated? There's a lot of things we can cover with that. It's a way to fortify yourself against any form of AI manipulation or people manipulation. I kind of think humanity needs it right now, but that's another discussion, but typically you can test yourself on it. You can go from muscle testing to just galvanic skin response. But when AI winds up getting telemetry on us, that's another story. That's where we really kind of have to start having the real deep discussion, because it will know us far better than we could possibly know ourselves.
A lot of folks on the phones. We're not going to be able to get to all those calls. I appreciate the callers who did get in, and apologies to those who were not able to connect. But I want to ask you, Brian, how do people follow what you're doing? Do you have platforms, other than doing interviews like this, do you have a platform or a plan where people can learn more about this?
Come out and hang out in my garage. No, but generally, I do Twitter a lot, my first and last name. You know, I don't want to spell it out. I have sort of a magazine that I run, and I don't guarantee that I'm always going to write about the same stuff. It's at readmultiplex.com or just multiplex.com and click the link. And I'm trying to help people learn how to prompt. And so I'm going to put together Prompt University, promptengineer.university. It's instead of .com.university. And I'm hoping that we can just educate as many people as possible and fortify them with understanding that this is a powerful learning tool. But, yes, this is also potentially can be used against you.
I hope it can help us with sort of the planet is changing. People don't want to agree on what the causes of the planet changing are. But, boy, we're at a critical point, it seems. And hopefully AI might be able to pitch in on that one to some degree.
I sure hope so. I think that if we can use this in a way to enrich ourselves, we can actually make the next big leap. And perhaps it is AI and humanity forming not a brain interface, but maybe just a partnership that would be stronger.
Brian, thanks so much for being here. I learned so much. But now I've got better questions that I need to ask, and we'll need more time. So we'll work something out, all right?
Absolutely, George. Such an honor and pleasure. I've been listening to you for so long, and being on the show is just amazing.
Awesome. Thanks for being here and staying up late with us. That's Brian Romilly. We have connections, that links to his stuff on the Coast to Coast website. Thanks also to Darcy Weir and to my colleagues there at Coast, to Donna Walker and Michael Cosio, Lex Lonehood, Dan Galandi, Chris Boros, Lisa Lyon, Tom Danheiser, George Norrie, of course. I'm George Knapp. I'll be back next Sunday night. Hope you can tune in then. Good night, everyone.